So what we saw last time was that we could describe the imperfections in neutron interferometry, and that we could describe them in terms of a rotation angle, which ideally we would like to be 90 degrees, so that we would create, we would go from having an eigenstate of the system, of the interferometer, to having an equal superposition and having the system coherently spanning two paths. And so this is ideal pi over 2, and in reality, something different. And I gave you the experimental data so you could figure that out. And of course, this piece doesn't change the purity of the system at all, right? All it does is say that we don't have the maximum modulation that we possibly could have. And so if we wanted to get the most information per unit noise, then this should be 90 degrees. And then we had these, we had a phase flag, perhaps we would have a sample somewhere, and that in addition, we would have some noise. And we saw that it didn't matter where we assigned the noise, as long as it was inside the interferometer, that the noise on all of the surfaces of the blades is just going to add randomly. And so we can think about it as having just one noise parameter. And the noise, of course, really does matter, that if I look at the Ramsey fringe experiment, so now we have a Bloch sphere, and what we would like to do is to rotate here, have our phase rotation, and of course, if I have the sample and the beam, this rotation would be the sum of those two. And then in addition to this, there would be a distribution due to the noise. And so, of course, if we have this distribution to the noise, if we were looking at the density matrix of the process, and so the density matrix says we're looking at repeated instances, and so we're going to average over, we're going to average our measurement here, intensity, over many instances. And of course, you wanted the density matrix to say, oh, I'm going to average over identical instances. In this case, the instances aren't identical because the position of the neutron will vary slightly. Its position of the neutron varies. Everything will be the same except for this noise. And so then the vector described by this density matrix would shrink due to that variation, right? And so here we, in fact, lose purity. And although we've lost that purity, if we could go back and look at one instance, and one instance, of course, would be one location, we can come close to that with a position-sensitive detector, then, of course, the purity is recovered. And if you look at the notebook, then there was some images with position-sensitive detectors, and you could see that, oh yes, if I have an integrating helium-3 detector, I would lose, contrast would be gone. But if I look at the position-sensitive detector, contrast is returned. Good. And I wanted to make one more point here. That experimentally, from the data, you can see these two effects. So if I look at the O-beam, The O beam has an intensity like this. And of course, if I change this angle, so this is phi. If I change this angle, then what happens is it's going towards this result, right? This is the result of loss of modulation. So that's the theta becoming small, or theta becoming pi, you know, both of those. But if I added lots of noise, then I would go to the 50-50 case, right? And so the, you know, if you like, the fixed points of those maps are very different.
Yeah.
All right. Now, since we've been talking about coherence, at this point, there's usually a question, which I haven't gotten yet. Stay there. No?
The effect of the gravity going upstairs.
Okay. Well, you know, we're interested in looking at neutron interferometry as a function of gravity, so I should take it and make it into my lab. Let's say, for illustration, that I go and I split that middle blade. I want to split that middle blade just so that I'm going to be able to say, ah, I've got this neutron interacting with this. And you will agree with me that if the middle blade, so now I have two middle blades, if these know which path the neutron took, our contrast goes away. You will agree with me. At least a few of you will. Good. So we're saying, these middle blades, they can't learn that the neutron hit them. But of course, the momentum that's given to the neutron is very different in both cases, right? The change in momentum. So of course, I can say, well, no, those are two separate events. But I showed you the data. We really do have contrast. So why is it that in this interferometer, and it's not because we were using one blade, we have plenty of interferometers with holes in them, though I didn't show you that data. If I look at this interferometer, why do I see contrast at all? Okay, now I'm going to say, look, I take this interferometer again. And now I'm going to randomly move it up and down. So we'll just put it, I'll just move it up. We'll make it easy. I lose contrast. Right? So in this case, you know, I've just amplified this effect, and I lose contrast. So it's not quite to say. Remember, it's not the. You don't lose contrast because you didn't look at something. You lose contrast when the experiment could have told. You know, it's not, you know. You don't enter into the problem of when we're writing down the equations of saying, oh, yes, I know, and I didn't look, right? You have to set up the experiment so that the experiment cannot tell. And so what is it about this experiment that allows us to still have contrast? So let's write down an equation. Let's say that we have the neutron coming in. So that's the input. And then I'm going to write down a function. I'm going to write it down in this way. I'm going to say that I have the density matrix of blade one tensor identity on blade two plus identity on blade one tensor, that's on blade two. Okay, I want to keep for now that these things are separate blades. Okay, and they don't know about each other. That's what that says, right? They don't know about each other. Okay, and so then we say, well, I have the output state of the neutron. And you know, this we can write down really easily. Yep. And then tensor, well, I have the output state of each of these things. And I'm going to simply require that they remain unentangled. But that's not the interesting piece. It's just another question I don't want to get into here. So what do we require that says, oh, I can see contrast here? We want the trace of these things to be one. Right? I don't want any distinguishability in this. And you say, well, okay, what happened? Well, this blade is in some complicated thermal state. And therefore, as it's interacting, well, it comes out in some complicated thermal state. It doesn't need to be exactly the same thermal state. In fact, it better not be the same thermal state because it really did interact with the neutron. But the distinguishability of those two states is very, very low. And of course, if I cooled the blade and I said, oh, let me describe the blade by a pure state, well, then we would be dead, right? We would lose all contrast. And so, you know, that's good. It says, oh, if I want to do, instead of optomechanics, I want to do neutron mechanics. You know, bouncing neutrons off quantum mechanical devices. Well, you can do that, but you'd better make sure that your system allows you to have such distinguishabilities. Yeah?
So I can see how that would be true if you're talking about entangling the neutron with the blade.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's a good question. And you say, if I go and I want to show that there was a loss of contrast, then at some point I do need to be able to entangle those two, right? But I don't need... Go through the analysis. I don't need to have distillable entanglement over that. I need an entangling operation. And the piece that's going to come out of this is that, which is why I write it like this, that this is going to be the criteria. It's very tempting just to say, oh, well, I got these two plates, and now what's going to happen is I'll no longer have this sort of structure, right? But it's going to be enough, in fact, that this is not equal to one.
Yeah, I mean, like, I can see that.
Yeah. I mean, you're perhaps worried that there's a lot of, that this is more constrained than if I just said, oh, let's take all this and just replace it with row 1, 2.
No, I wondering if you write it like that, then wouldn't there not be any loss of coherence either way because the two, because you haven't entangled with the blades at all?
So the so you would still have a reduction that would show up as a difference in phase. And so so go through the analysis and have a look. But the you know, the clearly one way of getting a loss of contrast is to entangle. But if I entangle those two objects, then you're going to want me to have a coherence supported between these two blades. And in fact, we don't require that for the loss of contrast, right? We require that there's an entangling operation, but I don't require that I maintain a coherence between the two macroscopic objects.
Between the blade and the neutron.
So even there, you know, it's not to say that, that we're maintaining a coherence. We're saying that, that there's an information that we could extract, right? The challenge is information. It's not the challenge of coherence. Yeah?
I'm just concerned about the use of counterfactuals here. I mean, you say that problem is if the experiment could have told you something. And in what sense is that word could being used? Because I mean, any experiment could tell you something if you carried out an additional measurement and made something else.
Okay, so I worry about these in principle experiments as you worry about these controversial experiments. And
I just want clarity on what could it means in this.
Yes, experiment. Absolutely. And that's why I write it this way. That's what it means. So the, you know, how much of an opportunity do we have to extract that information? We have an opportunity to the extent that this overlap is not perfect. And then, you know, once you have that opportunity, then you can ask, okay, can I arrange an experiment so that I could make use of that opportunity?
I could also extract that information by just inserting it into path one. In what sense is that a different kind of opportunity?
Oh, yeah, that's right. You could say, and of course, you know, those things are done. Let's say that I take my neutron interferometer. This is an experiment that can be done, but that hasn't been done yet, unfortunately. Or maybe it's fortunate, because then I can still do it. We can take a squid, so a superconducting quantum interference device, and only two. And using a squid, we can detect the magnetic field of a neutron. And so then I could say, I can do this and I can detect that magnetic field. And that's great. You say, this is going to now allow me to show that I could detect the path and still have coherence. But of course, what happens is as I detect the path, then I slow down the neutron, right? There's an interaction. And there's a couple ways of thinking about that. One,
that because I'm converting that information in the squid into a classical outcome, I inject noise. And so the back action actually has noise on it. And so then it becomes very much like the screen that's behind here. The other thing that you can think of is, what's going to happen is I slow down the neutron and I move it out of its coherence line. We'll talk about that. And then therefore, you know, they can no longer interfere with each other once they arrive here. Or you can say that, there's a third picture of this. They'll come to me later on in the lecture. But you know, yes, you can go and you can say, let me detect a neutron, but of course, it doesn't let you violate any of these, right?
What I mean is, why is the fact that I could have done that different from the fact that I also could have measured the momentum of the blade?
So here, of course, I could set this experiment up and I could say, if I condition on the knowledge that I have this, or I don't condition on that knowledge, can I look at the state that I would have coming out of the interferometer? Okay. Here, unfortunately, you know, we don't have that conditioning piece. Are they different? Not really. I mean, in this case, the squid is going to give us a nice, clean indicator of having a single quantum event. And the blade, of course, is complicated enough that this thing becomes so close to one that we don't have the experimental resources to extract the difference.
I mean, suppose to go to set up where there is a difference and
mm-hmm.
it's big enough that we could measure it, but we don't.
Yeah.
How is that different from the fact that we could have put the squid in and measured the path and we don't?
But you lose contrast though in that situation.
That's
yeah, I don't
right.
know why.
You lose contrast because in both cases there's a back action.
But
and
so
the back action is going to give you.
In neither case you actually you make the measurement. It's just a possibility. Why is one possibility different from the other possibility?
Mm. Okay, let's try to contrast two pieces. Normally, what I think of is to say, I set up this experiment and I either turn on the amplifier and record this output or I don't, okay? And you're saying, alternatively, you could have a choice of whether you put it in or not, right? And there's, for your example, there's a nice paper by Wheeler on delayed choice. Have you seen? Did it come up in any of your classes? No? Would you? And what Wheeler says is in exactly this geometry. What would happen if I wait until the neutron has passed this blade? So we can do that because I can say, let me chop the neutron beam so it's coming in pulses. And I know the velocity. So I can say, I know that the wave packet has to be in this place. And at that instance, you decide whether you're going to put in another beam splitter here or not. And then his argument is, hey, how is it possible that you would have this? Because what he wants to argue is that, once it's passed the first blade, it had to be taking one of these two paths. And therefore, you know, the fact that you put a beam splitter in or not can't do anything interesting. It's if you read Wheeler's paper, he makes it much more compelling than what I just did. Okay, so I suggest you read his paper. Since you took the course by Joseph, he's much better at talking about these things than I am too. But to get to the point, when you've decided to make let's take it this way. Let's say that I take the model that says I'm going to choose the measurement apparatus, the squid, so that I delay the wave packet so that they no longer come together at the third blade. Okay? So now then, we go, we put the squid in there, and we see that there is a loss of contrast, that the contrast goes away. And then I can say, well, what if I made a measurement condition on that outcome? Could I return the contrast? Okay, so that, you know, I say, I know that this was here. That's a very good.
Is that just a matter of scale? Like with the squid experiment, you could have a very weakly interaction, interacting measurement that doesn't lose contrast. And then in the other case, you could have some really, really tiny blades that get affected by the neutron so much that you do lose contrast.
Yes, that's right. And in the end, if you go through the analysis, it'll work out well. But the point I wanted to make, and I'm failing miserably, is to say, imagine that I delay this, so that we've really measured this. And so now I have my wave packet, and I have my wave packet. And then, let's over here, let's scatter the neutron off another crystal and make a more precise measurement of its momentum. So here I say, okay, I want to measure the momentum precisely. And so let's draw. Here, I have a distribution of momentum, k. That's a probability of k. And here I have a wave packet. And the width of this wave packet goes as 1 over delta k. You like a factor of 2 pi, put in a factor of 2 pi. Okay? So the piece that we're looking at here is defined by the properties of the neutrons that we're looking at. Right, so it's the properties over the distribution of neutrons we're looking at. Now here, by putting in a measurement, I can make this distribution really sharp in K. And I'm now going to detect Q. And so now that I've said, okay, I'm only going to filter out those neutrons that have this momentum, which fits somewhere inside here. Now then, of course, the effective wave packet of these neutrons is much larger, much longer. And they overlap. And so in this measurement, I'll see contrast. But in this measurement, if I look here, or I can say I look here, I don't see contrast. I don't know if that makes anything clearer.
It's weird.
Yeah.
So the squid isn't recording anything or keeping any information?
So let's say that the squid is set up to your equipment, it keeps information. We're going to lock it away in the room next door. I'm not going to give you the key.
But as you were saying, whether or not you know about the information, that shouldn't matter.
That's right.
That's the magic.
Yeah.
Does it have to be a squid, or can it just be a phase delay?
Oh, no problem. So we could say, that's a much nicer experiment. Let me put a piece of bismuth here. So bismuth has a big coherent cross section, slows it, it runs down really, really well, but it doesn't absorb any. Okay? So now then, at this point, you have your wave packets aligned, and here, they're out of the line. And so, easy to arrange that they come out in different times. Let me give you, let me describe an experiment as we actually do it, and then we'll be able to get more concrete. So if I take a neutron, and I send it through the same prism that we're talking about last class, then we can define an index of refraction, right? So the index of refraction is just the rate of change of the wave number. And so what will happen is that if I have two prisms, then the neutron beam will be shifted by an amount delta z. And if I put these two prisms here, and I change the separation between them, then I can change the amount, the height of that separation. And I can change that up to microns. So this can be microns. And of course, neutrons much, 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 much smaller than microns. And we're doing it in the z direction, so we're going up. And the reason for that is that in the other directions, the coherence length is really actually quite long. And so it becomes so long, it's inconvenient to work with. And in the z direction, the coherence length need not be that long. So microns is good. So now then, I look at the contrast, so put a phase flag in. And so the, the beams are ideally coming in like this, and they were splitting them up. And we're going to end up moving outside the coherence length. And as we do that, we still have a spread of momentum along the z-axis in this. And so we're going to pick up a phase shift that's going to look like e to the I k delta z, right? It's going to be the difference in those two. We're going to integrate that over the probability of k. And, of course, those would be the normal phases. But this is the phase that's going to allow us to see that we lose contrast. And if this was a delta function, well, life would be good. We would have one phase, right? And, of course, we would be talking about plane waves. If we have plane waves, then we say, fine, it doesn't matter how far we shift them relative to each other. They're always going to interact with each other. And the only difference will be that we will get the phase. We will get the phase that is exactly this periodic. Yeah. So here we say, oh, yes, we'll see this structure. And I'll show you some data. Okay. So over here, I plotted the reductions, the contrast, and it's a reduction. As I've increased the separation of the two beams, right, so we're changing the distance between the prisms, we're increasing the separation. And there's a bunch of cases, I'm going to tell you what those are. But you can see that the contrast, as I increase the separation, decreases in the system. And I didn't show you, but we have a reactor. The reactor has a cold source. The cold source sends it onto a beam guide. In the beam guide, there's a crystal that reflects the neutrons out. It goes to another crystal, and then it goes to, let's see if I can do the geometry a little bit better than that. Then it goes to a set of crystals that all are focused on the interferometer. And the reason we do that is the guide is about a foot thick. And so if I just took a centimeter out of the neutrons, then I wouldn't have that many neutrons. And so what we do is we have two monochromators to select the momentum. And then at the end, I have a so-called focusing monochromator that will take that beam and will focus it on the interferometer so that all of the neutrons come in together. And so I get more counts. But if I get more counts, then so this is the focusing monochromator. And if I looked at the spread in the momentum, which we can measure. If I have 9 blades or 5 blades or 1 blade, then of course, because it's a focusing monochromator, every blade is at a slightly different angle. The change in momentum is small, but they're at a slightly different angle. So this is momentum, and you can see that the units are, that's 5/1000ths of the momentum. And if I have 1 blade, I get this nice Gaussian distribution because there's some thermal noise on the crystals. And then if I have 5 blades, I get 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And if I have 9 blades, I get 9. And you can see that they really do have this structure. And so if I go now and I look at these curves, well, this is the loss that I see for 1 blade. And that's the loss, of course, I see for 9 blades. And as I increase from 1 to 2 to 3 to 5 to 7, oh, I'm sorry, we didn't show it out here, because of the 7. That the contrast falls off more quickly because the spread of momentum is broader, so that the wave packet is smaller. Right? I have a bigger spread of momentum up there somewhere. This wave packet, which is a small spread of momentum, has a long coherence length. And as I go out in momentum, the coherence length becomes sharper and sharper. And of course, as I change the separation between these two, I push the beams further and further and further apart, then we see the contrast falls off, and it falls off depending upon the width of the wave packet. And of course, that data is exactly this. That's the Fourier transform of the momentum distribution, right? That's all this is. And so directly, we can measure the momentum distribution by putting a chopper there or by scattering a crystal off of a crystal, or we can measure the momentum distribution by changing the delay between the arrival of these two wave packets and measuring the contrast and seeing where they're coherent. Okay? Somehow I think I've lost people.
So are you saying that because of the spread of momentum, you then have shorter wave packets, and then they're more likely to then become incoherent with each other?
Yeah. So
that would only be true for transform limited pulses, right? Like this direct relationship. Is that the case? Yeah.
We have one neutron by itself in there, and
okay, so each neutron is transform limited.
Yeah, that's right. And remember that although we talk about the wave packet of the neutron, you know, it's the same reactor. We haven't changed anything. The neutrons are going through. You know, what we're seeing is the wave packet of the experimental apparatus, right? The experimental apparatus is determining the wave packet. And if you could imagine, which I can't, saying, oh, I want to know what happens for only one neutron. Well, presumably a neutron is traveling and it has a really long coherence length. But, you know, I'm not sure that it's a worthwhile thing to try to talk about. So here we say, okay, I can arrange these wave packets to go out of the coherence length, out of their coherence distance. And of course, just to be simple about the whole thing, if I put another set of prisms there, you know, if I delay them both, of course I return contrast, right? It's always going to be the difference in the arrival in the depth space.
Yeah. I noticed on the bottom two curves there was sort of revival of contrast, little wiggles at the bottom.
Yeah.
Where did those come?
So. Back up here. So they're from. Now, if I look at this one, there's no revivals. Right, there's revivals here because I have this picket fence type structure. And so there's a periodicity there. And so there's these accidental revivals because the distribution's non-Gaussian. If I had just smeared this out and had a Gaussian that was continually broadening there wouldn't be any revivals. But that's a result of having these nine blades there. Okay, so now then, let's look at this, at the wave function coming out of that piece. So don't measure it yet. And everything is coherent and everything is perfect. What's the wave function coming out of that path? Well, I know that it's in the state zero, right? Because we said that we're going to label based upon the x momentum, sign of the x momentum, right? So it's zero. But that's not enough, right? It can't be just zero. So it's zero. I'm going to add a coordinate. Delta z equals zero plus zero delta z. Do this all the time. Let's just call it like that. And let's take it as an equal superposition. Let's say that our headlines are perfect.
How would I do that?
Yes.
For the function to be zero.
Oh, thank you. There we go. So this degree of freedom. Is the displacement to the neutron beam. Right, so now I have a coherent superposition of the beam displaced and not displaced.
Do you have four prisms or two prisms?
In this case, let's think about two prisms. If I had four prisms, it would be the difference in those. But let's keep two, it's nice and easy to think about. This, of course, is coherent, and I should have put in here e to the I k delta z, right? That there's a phase difference between those two, and the phase difference is because of being translated. So now then we say, okay, this is good. I've got my coherence, and so coming out of this, I have a coherent superposition of the neutron traveling at two heights, but with exactly the same momentum. And if I want to observe that piece, well, if I'm outside the coherence line, then what does that say? It says that the variation, that if I take this integral, that delta z times k wraps around many times. Just like we talked about before, that we've got a phase which is wrapping around by some wave number. And we have some distance that we've set, delta z. The difference between yesterday's lecture and this one is that now this is fixed, and this varies. And so I won't be able to draw this, but imagine you have different elements of your distribution with different helices, and you're sampling those at delta z, right? That's what we're doing here. And so if I integrate over that distribution, but I'm free, I say, well, okay, this is classical. So all I need to do is to restrict the neutrons that I detect to being just those neutrons where k is precisely known. And then this just becomes a fixed phase over those neutrons I'm detecting, and I will see coherence. Where if I sample over a wide range of momenta, then this becomes a random phase, and of course I don't see coherence. And we do that, again, by the experiment that I lost over there, by putting another crystal here, scattering off of it and selecting the momentum. And when we do that experimentally, we recover the contrast.
I'm really confused.
Okay.
So when you're talking about sampling all of the different momenta,
yeah.
What I imagine is happening that is you've got many of these neutrons coming in and you're treating each one of them to be incoherent.
Right.
It's a statistical mixture of all of these neutrons coming in.
Says, put a helium-3 detector there.
But if I have a statistical mixture of all these neutrons coming in and I want to describe like the wave function of that whole thing, I then can't think of that as a transformer that it like, helps if I don't have many of these neutrons. And so then this argument between like selecting out a particular K and then shortening or lengthening the, how do we go? A particular K, yeah, it shortens your wave packet.
Yeah.
And then, like, it's really, I don't really follow what's going on.
So I think in some ways, you're making it a little bit too hard.
Well, I just don't know whether you're looking at one particle or many particles.
So remember that the wave packet is described for an ensemble. And it's always, we're always going to define the wave packet for the ensemble that we measure. Right? It's not, don't think about it as defining it for the ensemble that the reactor spews out, right? Because you know that they're born hot and you know they would have a wave packet which is really really small. So we have our neutrons impinging on here, and of course, although you know we don't keep track of it, most of the neutrons are going this way, right? So we have distribution of momentum. But most of them, we're never going to measure. And so we say, well, it's post-selected that I have a distribution, and it's post-selected by they had to arrive at that detector. So given your wide range of momentum here, at this point, we have some distribution of momentum. And in fact, if we look at that plot, that distribution could have some structure depending upon the experimental piece. And then given this, since I know the distribution of momentum, then I can directly develop the wave packet for that. And then over here, I say, well, okay, at this point, I have this distribution of momentum. And now I'm going to scatter off this crystal. And so now I have a very much narrower distribution of momentum. And so here, I'm going to see contrast. And of course, it wouldn't matter which element of this I looked at, I would see contrast. But if I looked at each of those elements, and then I asked, well, what is the effective phase of each of those elements, it would be different. And if my experiment averages over all of those, then I lose contrast. But if it doesn't, then I recover contrast. Now, if you wanted to say this in the language that you want to use.
Like, if you turn it around, I think it's yeah, so I can think about all of these situations where I pick out all of these different delta function phase.
Yeah.
But now if I want to model the detector that doesn't select these, then I can take a statistical mixture of all of those results, and then of course I lose contrast.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But it's kind of weird thinking about it the other way, that you're selecting out, like, from an incoherent thing, you're selecting out a coherent thing.
It is. But I think it's useful to try and follow through for an experiment of what it means to lose contrast. And in this case, what it meant to lose contrast was that we were accepting too many events. And alternatively, you know, you can easily imagine, you could easily mock up a way of losing contrast where this measurement would look exactly the same, but we couldn't select over there and recover the contrast. Or let me put it differently. I couldn't select that way and recover the contrast. Yeah?
The weird thing is that it then makes you think that there's something fundamental about like the plane wave basis, like inside the interferometer. But I mean, the fact that's not true, because you could post like on something else and then
That's right. I mean, plane waves, of course, are a little bit tricky, right? Because they're a convenience for us to think about.
But like, you could imagine interpreting it, saying that like, really, there are all these plane waves in there that have contrast, and we just lose it at the detection end.
Yeah.
But you shouldn't think about it that way.
Right. Yeah. There's a paper by they will come to me. He takes a molecular beam. And he arranges that it's very monochromatic. And then he scatters it off with grating. And he has a laser here. That would excite a Raman transition if the laser fires while the particle is in a perfect, is in a spot. So here there would be a Raman transition. And over here he has a detector. To record the scattering of the light. So then he can tell you, hey, did the light interact with the atoms? If it did, how strong? And then of course what he does is sits out here on the fringe. And says, if he post-selects, so he only turns on the detector if this fires. Or he only turns on the detector if it fires at this spot. And so I'll find that paper for you, which will be easy as soon as I remember his name. Okay, so this wasn't the lecture I had planned. I hope it was fun. I hope it wasn't just confusing. Yeah. For your tutorial, I want to think about wave packets and to think about stationary states and look at this picture. And, you know, start off looking at it where you take the momentum of the incoming neutron beam as being a delta function. And then ask yourself what happens if you have a distribution of momentum. And what I think you'll see is that there'll be a natural transition that if you say, well, I have a delta function, you'll want to describe this by a stationary state. If I have a broad distribution, I won't want to do that. Okay. Other questions? All right. We'll try to keep conversations like this one for beers later.